Many of us across the United States have been captivated by college and university protests and demonstrations in support of Palestinian human rights. The movement began at New York's prestigious Columbia University and quickly spread all across the country, from major universities to small colleges. And they continue to spread to universities around the world. It has proven to be the biggest American campus political movement since the height of the Vietnam War. These demonstrations grew quickly and remained peaceful. So why did university administrators at almost every one of these institutions use campus and local police departments to break them up with violence? Why were students arrested for allegedly trespassing on their own campuses? And why did universities not even attempt to engage the students in a conversation about Palestine, about human rights, and about divestment from Israel? I'm John Kiriakou. Welcome to The Whistleblowers. Since the start of the war on Gaza on October 7th, 2023, many people around the world have been appalled by the Israeli response. Yes, October 7th saw the deaths of more than 1,200 innocent Israeli civilians. It was the worst terrorist attack in Israeli history. But Israel's response has been heavy-handed, and in the words of the United Nations, genocidal. More than 35,000 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces so far in the conflict, and most of them have been women and children. There's no end in sight to the conflict. Here in the United States, the initial shock and sympathy for Israeli civilians quickly dissipated with the fast rise in civilian deaths. Thousands of students set up encampments on university grounds calling for peace and for the universities to divest from investments in Israel. The logical next step would have been for university leaders to engage the students in a conversation and perhaps to consider their demands. But instead, the protests, which had been almost entirely peaceful, were met with violence. Police arrested students by the hundreds. They fired tear gas and rubber bullets, and they forcibly uprooted the tent encampments, destroyed them, and threw them away. Even worse, many of the universities led by Columbia had the students charged with crimes, including criminal trespassing. But if a student is trespassing, that means that he or she can't go to class. And worse, it means the student can't even go to his or her own student housing. So not only were the students arrested, they were also essentially thrown out of school and made homeless. It was a pattern that soon was repeated across the country. Our guest today has followed this issue very closely. He's been on campus with the students and has written about developments extensively. We're very happy to have Chris Hedges with us. Chris is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who was a foreign correspondent for 15 years for the New York Times, where he served as the Middle East bureau chief and the Balkan bureau chief for the paper. He previously worked overseas for the Dallas Morning News, the Christian Science Monitor, and National Public Radio. He's the host of the show, The Chris Hedges Report. Chris, thanks so much for joining us. We're glad to have you.
Thank you, John.
Chris, I'd like to begin with a very powerful piece that you wrote for Consortium News about the university demonstrations. At the very start of the article, you set a scene where the campus at Columbia University is locked down. Police have sealed off the entire neighborhood. Nobody can get in or get out. Why were things so severe? These were peaceful demonstrations aside from a broken window and a little bit of graffiti. Why the heavy-handedness?
Because these universities are not responding to the internal realities of these peaceful encampments. And they're responding to external pressure from powerful donors who support the Zionists, from the administration, the Democratic Party. They're not responding to the reality on the ground. So in fact, of course, they've exacerbated the problem. They've made it worse. They have sought, and unfortunately the media has echoed this, to define these encampments as an assault or against Israel, against Jews. I've been in several of these encampments many times in Columbia and Princeton, and I would say 30 or 40% of the people demonstrating are Jewish. In fact, I found it quite moving. They, both at Columbia and at Princeton, they hold Friday evening prayers, and then they hold Shabbat services for all of the students. And then on Sunday, actually, I'm ordained, I actually preached one Sunday at the service up at the Princeton encampment. We serve communion to everyone. So it's really moving, but that's why they, and that, of course, has enraged, as it should, these student protesters, because administrations are not only not carrying out any kind of, with very few exceptions, carrying out any kind of meaningful dialogue, but they're using draconian force. In the case of Columbia, we saw police enter the renamed Hamilton Hall, Hind Hall, with their guns drawn. In fact, a shot was fired inside the hall. A student was knocked, thrown down the stairs and knocked unconscious. People have been beaten. So that's the reason. The reason is they're not actually responding to what's happening internally on their own campuses. They're responding to, they're attempting to placate external pressure. And that's why you saw the presidents of Harvard and University of Pennsylvania, didn't do them any good, they're both gone, go down and grovel. Like the president of Columbia, before these right-wing troglodytes in Congress.
You make what I think is a very important point in this article. Columbia University's president, Manoush Shafiq, is a British-Egyptian baroness who made her career in places like the Bank of England, the World Bank, and the International Monetary Fund. She was in no mood to negotiate or even to have a conversation with students who were demanding change. Is this actually a class conflict at its core?
I would say it's in a way, yes. It's so universities, and of course I've taught at Columbia, Princeton, NYU, and a few others. They have been corporatized, and so they are now run on a corporate structure. So in the case of Shafiq, she doesn't come out of academia at all. She comes out of the corporate world. She comes out of the world of finance. And they've reconfigured or deformed these universities along corporate lines. So you have highly paid administrators. These are people pulling down salaries in the hundreds of thousands of dollars who often come out of the corporate world. And then you have, this is not so much true at the very elite private universities, but it is true at most universities. You then have the burden of the teaching falls on the shoulders of adjuncts who essentially replicate workers in the gig economy. They have no job security. They're actually paid by the course and not very much. $4,000 is often the norm. So they're making $24,000 a year without benefits, but they're carrying most of. So they've replicated the corporate model. They have attempted to monetize departments at the university, where they have to raise their own money, not only for research, but often for salaries. Well, that's very hard to do in the humanities, which is why the humanities are withering away, and why you see an increasing emphasis, and this is true at universities like Stanford or Princeton, which are private universities, you focus on STEM, on science, technology, economics, and math. And that is what the corporate world, and I should add the defense industry, wants. So some of this reaction, I think, is engendered by the fact that the people running these universities don't actually come out of academia. They are not scholars. They have been formed by the corporate world, and corporate hierarchies are a very totalitarian. You are not allowed to, if you work for a corporation, have any opinion that the corporation deems controversial or unpalatable. And that is also what has infected universities across the country.
One of the things that confused me from the very start of the demonstrations was why administrators didn't just let them run their course. They started near the very end of the school year. Students were going to go home at the end of the summer, they were going to graduate or start summer jobs or internships. So why the arrests, the expulsions, and the desire to snuff these demonstrations out?
because their job, I'm talking about the administrators and the presidents, their jobs were in jeopardy. Of course, you're right. I actually was speaking at the encampment at Princeton, and somebody came up with a megaphone. It wasn't mine, and held it. There was a few hundred students. There was a ban on amplified sound. There's also a ban on tents. So these poor kids are sleeping out, sometimes in the rain, wrapped in tarps and blankets. They're not allowed to bring sleeping bags. So campus security came over, I didn't stop. And then I couldn't see it. They were behind me. They started moving to arrest me, and the students got up and linked arms and surrounded me to prevent it. But of course, the whole reaction has been, again, for an external audience, not an internal audience. And when I was speaking afterwards to the head of campus security, I said, look, you know, you should let them put their tents up and deliver them pizzas every night for precisely the reason you just said. But in fact, what they have done is by not only not responding in a meaningful way to the demands, but by using this kind of outsized force to crush it, is that it spread like a wildfire. It's because for the points you point out, a rational response would have been the response that you just elucidated. But they're not responding to the kids. They're not responding to what happens on the campus. I mean, you know, they're arrested for trespassing. So these are students who have valid IDs. They're arrested for trespassing on their own campus. I mean, the whole thing is, you couldn't kind of make it up.
One of the lies that university, city, and police leaders have used to justify the crackdown has been that there were what they called outside agitators, people who were not students but who went to the demonstrations to provoke violence. It's my impression that this was a red herring, that there really were no outside agitators. What was your experience?
Well, there are people from the outside who join the protests, but this is a student-driven protest. So what they're attempting to do is say that it's not, it's not born out of the university setting, but has been provoked by people on the outside. That, of course, is completely untrue. Just like the idea that these encampments are somehow anti-Semitic or anti-Jewish. In fact, of course, I would say the students who receive the most harassment are those Jewish students who support the encampments from Zionists. But we have seen a series of, not only with the violence by a Zionist mob against the encampment at UCLA, but at Columbia and other places, people have been jeered, pushed, punched. And in the case that we had three former Israeli soldiers who were students at Columbia use skunk spray that is invented by the Israelis. It's a very noxious spray. They sprayed three protesters on the steps of Lowe Library at Columbia. And I think that's another frustration that the real assaults are being carried out by the Zionists and they're overlooked. And then, of course, the group itself or the encampments themselves are mischaracterized, as you point out, as being run by outside agitators and mischaracterized as being anti-Semitic. And this is just really a way to divert, and the media, of course, my old employer, the New York Times, has been awful on this. It is a way to divert attention from the fundamental issue, which is the genocide that's taking place in Gaza.
Chris, I'd like to ask you to stay with us. We're going to talk about some of the effects that we're seeing in the media stemming from these demonstrations, and I'm including the so-called independent media. We're going to take a short break, but stay tuned. We'll be right back.
The behavior has become really extreme in the West, and I think again it's because their empire is on the decline. It's rapidly declining. They see it falling, and it just makes them more angry, more hostile, and more full of hatred.
since World War II, the United States has fostered extremist anti-Russian prejudices and hatreds among the Ukrainian diaspora in at least Canada, the United States, and countries in Eastern Europe, probably everywhere in the world. It doesn't matter what these groups say or do. It will support them if the groups are causing hatred and chaos within the target country.
Вся идеология Майдана, она как раз была чисто сектантской идеологией.
Среди военнослужащих вооруженных формирований Украины большое количество лиц, которые придерживаются языческих ритуалов.
Мы не христианцы, мы язычники.
So the CIA uses anyone and anything. If there's a religion,
welcome back to the Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. We're speaking with Chris Hedges. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who was a foreign correspondent for 15 years for the New York Times, where he served as the Middle East bureau chief and then the Balkan bureau chief for the paper. He previously worked overseas for some of the most important news outlets in America. He's the host of the Chris Hedges Report. Good to have you with us, Chris.
Thank you, John.
Chris, you have what I consider to be one of the most important and informative programs in independent journalism. It's called the Chris Hedges Report and has been available not just on your Substack, but also at the Real News Network. You recently interviewed former Congressman Dennis Kucinich for the show. Dennis is a serious political figure, a longtime peace activist, and even a former presidential candidate. But out of the clear blue sky, the Real News Network, a major independent outlet, not only decided to drop you, but also removed your interview with Dennis Kucinich. What happened at the Real News? Was this a result of outside pressure?
I can only speculate what happened or why. The official reason was that the interview with Dennis, as well as my own show, jeopardized their nonprofit status. Nothing that I said with Dennis, I did not endorse him, which would have jeopardized nonprofit status. They couldn't point to any examples of any show that I'd done where that was true, because I haven't. But they really have one major funder, a guy named T.M. Scruggs. He's come for me before. I wrote a column for SheerPost defending Alice Walker from charges that she was an anti-Semite, and he demanded that the publisher of the Post, Bob Scheer, remove the article or he would revoke the funding. He was a major funder for the site. Bob refused, and he cut off the funding. He has told The Real News, according to Max Alvarez, who runs The Real News, that if they do anything to contribute to the election of Donald Trump, they will lose their funding. That's just an inverted way of saying support Joe Biden and the Democrats. I have been a long supporter of third-party candidates. Indeed, I was Ralph Nader's speechwriter. He knows that. Dennis is running as an independent. Dennis in the interview was critical of both of the parties. And so that episode was removed, and then my show was immediately terminated. But this is part of the diminishing space within the news industry. Remember, a decade ago, myself, Matt Taibbi, Glenn Greenwald, we were mainstream. We had voices within the mainstream. That's all been shut down. When you have wealthy donors controlling news sites, this is true in Salon, which was founded by David Talbot, and its inception was very good, Alternet and other sites, then they essentially destroy, I would call it, any kind of journalistic integrity. In fact, the voices of people like Dennis, it's important that we give a platform to those voices, because the legacy media, commercial media, blocks them out. They have no platform at all. So that's what happened. I'll reconstitute it. It'll just be a technical headache, but it can be reconstituted. And I would say, the other thing that I find very cynical is that I drove most of their traffic. I mean, those shows had hundreds of thousands of views, several shows over a million, a few shows over 2 million. There's nothing on the site that comes close to that. But what they cared about, obviously, was the money, not the content.
Let's talk specifically about the Kucinich interview. I watched the interview, and I kept waiting for him to say something outrageous, something offensive or dangerous. And of course, he didn't. He was his normal self. So what was it that the Real News Network was objecting to? Or did it really have nothing to do with Dennis Kucinich?
Well, it had something to do with Dennis in that he's not running as a Republican or a Democrat. And also the fact that he was critical of both Biden and Trump. And that was just unpalatable. I mean, if you read the statement, it was they canceled the show because I might jeopardize their nonprofit status, which is ridiculous, because the shows are not live. They're pre-taped. If there was anything I said that jeopardized their nonprofit status, it could be corrected or they wouldn't have to run it. But I wouldn't do that anyway. I mean, I understand the rules. But I do think it is important to give a platform to people like Dennis. He's a very serious politician, served many years in the House, as you said, was an anti-war presidential candidate, an incredibly thoughtful former mayor of Cleveland. I mean, I think this is unfortunately the power of donors. No, there was nothing in the interview. There was nothing incendiary at all in the interview. It was quite a thoughtful, careful, reasoned discussion of our political situation and the kind of death trap that we've been forced into with these two major ruling parties. I mean, having worked for Nader, I saw how the two ruling parties conspire to essentially make it impossible for third-party candidates or independents to mount a credible campaign. And they do that because they're funded by the same forces, Northrop Grumman and Raytheon and Goldman Sachs and Citibank and everyone else. It didn't make any sense. I mean, the reaction, of course, has been quite fierce against what they did, as it should be, because I didn't violate any rules or norms. I just waded into a discussion, and I don't know this for a fact, but I pretty strongly suspect enraged their principal donor, and they decided that donor was more important than myself because they wanted their money.
Where does independent journalism go from here, Chris? It's tough enough to make a living as an independent journalist. It's tough enough for those outlets to raise enough money to keep going. How can they and how should they confront outside pressures to either skew the news or shut them down?
Well, the only model left that works, clearly the model of the wealthy donor doesn't work. We tried that at Truthdig. We had a wealthy publisher who funded the site, and then she tried to fire the editor-in-chief, Bob Scheer. I organized a strike among all but two of the staff, and then she fired all of us. The site still exists, but it's a shadow of itself. I don't think anyone reads it, nor should they. So the model is the subscription. So I'm on Substack. That article that you spoke about, The Nation's Conscience, originally came out on Substack. So people pay like $6 a month, and that funds my work. That works. That's how Matt Taibbi survives. That's how Glenn Greenwald survives. I think it's difficult for people who aren't known quantities to get enough of a subscription base to continue their work. That worries me. So young journalists, you know, I when I began my journalism career in the early 80s, I freelanced for all sorts of newspapers that had foreign, I was overseas in Central America, freelanced for the Philadelphia Inquirer, the Baltimore Sun, the Boston Globe, the Christian Science Monitor, National Public Radio. That's dried up. Even that freelancing work is dried up. I worry. I worry about the state of journalism, especially on the local level. I think it's a serious problem. I mean, those of us who have established reputations can get enough subscribers to be able to do our work. But I think that's because we come into the public consciousness as known entities. And it's very frightening. And I've my entire career, I have seen the collapse of an industry, however flawed, and I worked for publications like the New York Times that had many flaws. However, the death of journalism, I mean, the major city papers now are a shadow of what they were. I was in the Philadelphia Inquirer newsroom. They actually sold their building, but before they sold it, they used to have 750 reporters and editors. They were down to 200. So that meant that more than three quarters of the desks were empty. It was really frightening, really eerie, but drove home the point that journalism as an industry is collapsing. I mean, everything's going down. Vice News, I mean, I don't read Sports Illustrated, that's gone. And if my friend Sidney Shanberg, if you've ever seen The Killing Fields, was based on his reporting with Dith Prawn, another friend in Cambodia, you know, he was pushed out of the New York Times. But he said, you know, we may not have made things better, but maybe we stopped things from getting worse. And I think that's right, because once communities, the police department, the courts, it goes dark, there's no outside observer at all, then we see an escalation of the abuse of power. And then let's not forget Julian Assange. The persecution of Julian Assange is done quite consciously to essentially intimidate and shut down any investigations into the inner workings of power. And the persecution of Julian, or what Niels Melzer calls the slow motion execution of Julian Assange in Belmarsh prison, where he's now been held for 5 years, is a message to the rest of us. It doesn't matter, he's not American. It doesn't matter where you're from, what nationality you're from. If you expose the crimes that we commit, then we will find you anywhere in the world, extradite you, and put you in prison for the rest of your life. I mean, the CIA discussed worse than that. Of course, they discussed kidnapping him while he was seeking refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, or assassinating him.
One final question about the situation in Palestine, Chris. You're an old Middle East hand. Is there any opportunity for peace in the midst of all this devastation? Can you envision a change in global public opinion that could result in the Israelis or the Americans finally allowing the Palestinians the same rights and freedoms that the Israelis have?
Not in the short term, but in the long term, yes. I think that that older Biden generation, they have a kind of an emotional tie to Israel. I think we see now, and I'm speaking, of course, even among American Jews, those ties are no longer there. Israel has been exposed for what it is, an apartheid state that carries out either a slow motion or in this now in Gaza, very fast motion, ethnic cleansing and genocide. I don't think that's recoverable. But in the short term, especially because we give them billions and billions of dollars of weapons, they can decimate Gaza, and there are those within the Netanyahu cabinet who want to turn around and decimate the West Bank. In the short term, I don't hold out much hope. In the long term, I think Israel, which already has a kind of pariah status, has essentially created, including in countries in the United States, a generation that no longer has that kind of fealty to Israel, much less the ideology of Zionism. So, but unfortunately for those Palestinians in Gaza, I think the situation at the moment is pretty bleak.
Chris Hedges, thank you so much for your time. Former Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir once said disingenuously that peace could be achieved in the Middle East only when Arabs loved their children more than they hated Israel. I would say that the opposite is actually true. It's the Israelis that must give their Palestinian brothers, sisters, and neighbors the same respect and rights that they demand for themselves. And here in the United States, the government, the universities, the media, and indeed all of American society must practice what it preaches, whether for themselves or for Palestinians. Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. Please follow me on Substack at John Kiriakou. We'll see you next time.